Just a little bit of background as far as Daniel's time goes. The king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar is his name, he has just taken Israelites into captivity, taken Jews into captivity. And he's taken a pretty good amount of them. Among them were Daniel. He is the one who was fed to lions, but God shut the lions' mouths. And he got in good with the king, right? But in this account, he gets in good with Nebuchadnezzar by interpreting a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. He interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and in chapter 2, in verse 46, Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel. So that's the king who of Babylon, who has Daniel in captivity, fell on his face before Daniel and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel after Daniel had interpreted his dream for him, and he said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. That is a pretty high position of authority to give somebody who's your captive, isn't it? Who's from a different land. But it's all because of what God had done through Daniel. Also, in verse 49 of chapter 2, Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel's friends, over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So even Daniel's friends got something out of this because of the God that they served. It's interesting that Nebuchadnezzar called this God of the Israelites the God of gods and the Lord of kings, because he kind of goes back on that in chapter 3. Chapter 3 starts out with a decree from Nebuchadnezzar. He basically says, when you hear this certain kind of music, you must fall down and worship this gold image that I made. I made a golden idol, a god, for you to worship when you hear this kind of music, this specific kind of music. And if you don't fall down and worship this golden image, then you will be thrown into a fiery furnace. It's a simple law with a simple consequence. Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were accused of not falling down to worship this golden image. Nebuchadnezzar had just called God the God of gods and the Lord of kings, and then he turns around and makes this golden image. And he says he's going to persecute people who don't fall down to worship it. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are accused of not worshiping it. Let's pick up in verse 8 of chapter 3 in Daniel. It says, "Therefore at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace.' There are certain Jews whom you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon." These guys who got promoted because of Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they say, "They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up." He tells them they've not paid due regard to you. It's interesting. Nebuchadnezzar, the one who just called God the God of gods and the Lord of kings, wants worship and due regard for himself and for the God, the golden image that he created. He's going back on what he'd said. In verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. And he asks them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up?" So they have this accusation. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't really want to believe it at first. Is that true? And then he gives them a chance to. He gives them a chance to fall down and worship that golden image. Now, in order to understand why Nebuchadnezzar was a little bit confused, there's a cultural aspect of the Middle East, historically. Ancient cultures in the Middle East, including the Israelites, not that they did this, but they were included in the culture that did. It was very common for, if say, I lived in a different country, than, say, I lived in Egypt, but I went to Israel for something, it would be common for me to pay tribute to the god of that land. Or if I went to Philistia for something, it would be common for me to pay tribute to Dagon, the god of that land. Similarly, Nebuchadnezzar is expecting these people, since they're in captivity in his land, to pay tribute to the god of that land and to the king of that land by falling down and worshiping this golden image. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not polytheists like the rest of their surrounding area. They believed in the one true God, so they wouldn't fall down and worship that God. That's why Nebuchadnezzar was a little confused. So he gives them a chance to fall down and worship. He says, "Now if you are ready," in verse 15, "at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Remember, into chapter 2, the God of gods, the Lord of kings. Seems like it's just words now, doesn't it? "Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" is what Nebuchadnezzar says to them. I want us to note Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's response. In verse 16 and 17, they say two different things. Excuse me. Verse 16 through 18, they say two different things that we want to bring out. In verse 16 beginning, they respond and they say, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." Verse 17 says, "If that is the case, if you're going to throw us into this fiery furnace when we don't fall down and worship this golden image, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king." It's the first thing that they tell him. God is able to deliver us, and he will. The one true God. I like to draw an analogy. The heading of starting in verse 19, what happens to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, in my Bible says, "Saved in fiery trial." Fiery trial makes me think of the Apostle Peter's writings. It says, "Don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you." We'll go read that here in a little bit, but I like to pull the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and our trials, our temptations that we face, the things that we have to endure, and put those things together. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're faced with this trial. Nebuchadnezzar says, "You either fall down and worship this God, or I'm throwing you in this fiery furnace." And they say, "Our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. It doesn't matter what you do to me. My God is able to deliver me. And he will deliver me. My God is able to deliver me from this trial." That's a foundational belief that we have to hold on to with all of our might. In Acts 26, while Paul is recounting his conversion, Jesus says something really interesting to Paul. He starts out with, you know, you might remember, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It's hard for you to kick against the goads." And he says, "Who are you, Lord?" He says, "I'm Jesus, whom you're persecuting." Then he says, "But rise and stand on your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to make you a minister and a witness, both of the things which you have seen and of the things which I will yet reveal to you." Do you remember all those things that Paul suffered? It's in one of the Corinthian letters, but he just gives a list. And there's so many beatings, there's so many shipwrecks, there's hungering, there's thirsting. He spent a night and a day in the deep, he says. A lot of extreme things that he suffered at the hands of his Jewish brethren, at the hands of Gentiles. Jesus says in verse 17, when he commissioned Paul, he said, "I will deliver you from the Jewish people as well as from the Gentiles to whom I now send you." And he kept that promise. Time and time again, Paul faced danger after danger, and Jesus delivered him every time. If we're going to be as effective as Paul, if we're even going to be effective at all, we have to hold on to that idea that God can deliver us from the trials that we face. And he will. Paul is just one example. The next thing that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say to the king Nebuchadnezzar is in verse 18 of Daniel chapter 3. He says, "But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image which you have set up." So they start out with, God is able to deliver us. God will deliver us. And then, even if he doesn't deliver us, we're still not going to worship your gods or fall down and worship that golden image you created. Even if he doesn't, we're still going to serve the one true God. If my God chooses not to deliver me from my trial, I will still choose to serve him. Because there's a deliverance beyond that. He might not deliver us from the physical trial that we have here on this earth, but if we endure that patiently, there's a deliverance in heaven. Something that is even greater than the sufferings that we're going to endure here. In Romans chapter 8, Paul says it's not even able to be compared with the glory which we will receive. So they say, even if God does not deliver us, we're still going to serve him. Let's go to Acts chapter 7 really quick. In Acts chapter 6, some people are chosen, some men are chosen, men who are full of the Holy Spirit, and they are set before the apostles, and the apostles lay hands on them, and they are given some duties to accomplish so that the apostles can go do other things. Stephen is one of those men. And throughout chapter 7, he gives an address to some Jews who are accusing him of blasphemy. And starting off in verse 54, Stephen kind of gets to the end of his address. He calls them stiff-necked and uncircumcised. In verse 51, he says, "You always resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did, so do you." He's accusing them of not listening to what God has to say. In verse 54, "When they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, and they gnashed at him with their teeth. But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. And he said, 'Look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God.' Then they cried out with a loud voice, stopped their ears, ran at him with one accord. And they cast him out of the city and they stoned him." In verse 59 it says, "And they stoned Stephen as he was calling on God and saying, 'Lord Jesus, receive my spirit.' And he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, 'Lord, do not charge him with this sin.' And when he said this, he fell asleep." Don't you think it's interesting that God didn't save Stephen? Other times, like when Paul was stoned, he was just knocked unconscious. He didn't actually die. Or maybe the mob was angry, but a Roman soldier came and plucked Paul out of the masses and said, "You're coming with me. You guys wait. We're going to figure this out." Or other times when the apostles were brought into the Sanhedrin, instead of dying, they were just beaten. Or when Peter was in prison and he was waiting to be executed, that an angel came and his chains were loosed and they walked out together unnoticed by the guards. Why didn't God do something to keep Stephen from dying? I don't know. Might be because Stephen's death brought him glory and grew the church. But notice what Stephen did. He endured that trial. He knew God was able to deliver him from it. But he went through it anyway, patiently, righteously. And it brought God glory. Back in Daniel chapter 3, starting off in verse 19, after Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego respond to Nebuchadnezzar in that way, they say, God's able to deliver us, and even if he doesn't, we're still not going to do what you say. We're still not going to worship that golden image. In verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Think about that. You know, originally, these people were people he trusted to govern parts of his kingdom. And he trusted them through Daniel, too. And he gave them a chance to do what he thought was right of them to do. And they chose to obey God instead. His face changed. He got angry with them. He was full of fury. He commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. My parents have had a wood-burning stove probably since I was about first grade. They've had a wood-burning stove, and I grew up learning how to chop wood and cut down trees and stack the wood under the roof so that it would get seasoned and dry and burn well. And our furnace, we'd throw that wood in there and it would burn and it would heat the house and it would heat the water in the house. The furnace was hot, especially to a younger kid like myself. It had 2 doors. There was a door, a small door on the bottom, and a bigger door kind of in the middle where you would open, you would throw the sticks in. You're supposed to open the bottom door first and let the air get out there, and then open the top door, and then you can put the wood in. When I was young, I too often made the mistake of opening that top door first. And that fire wanted the oxygen outside the furnace, came right out at my face a couple times. It was hot. It made you cry because the smoke and the ashes and the heat got in your eyes. This furnace was heated to 7 times hotter than its normal heat. He commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army, the army of Nebuchadnezzar, to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace, this extremely hot furnace. These men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments and were cast into the midst of the fiery furnace. They even left the flammable stuff on them. Just throw them in there to burn. And this furnace was so hot, and the king's command was urgent, it says in verse 22, that the flame of the fire killed the men who took Shadrach, and Meshach, and Abednego up there to throw them in. Standing outside the furnace, these people died. That's how hot this fire was. The Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not burn. They fell down into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. But then in verse 24 it says, King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, didn't we cast 3 men in there bound? They answered and said, true, O king. He said, look, I see 4 men loose. That's not how many we put in there, and they certainly aren't tied up anymore. I see 4 men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the 4th is like the Son of God. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were right to trust in the Lord. They were right to expect God's deliverance from their trial. they were also right to allow themselves to get thrown into that fiery furnace and to not bow down and worship that golden image. They were delivered. But before they were delivered, they were cast in. We have to remember that. That fear was still probably there. When they went up to the door of that furnace and watched the people on either side of them die from the flames, that fear was probably still there. They had confidence in God. They were still people. We're still humans, and that fire was still hot. And they had to be thrown in. They were delivered, but first, they were thrown in. We should expect to have fiery trials of our own. Now we'll turn over to 1 Peter. We'll start out in chapter 1. First Peter chapter 1. In verse 6 he says, "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ." So we see that the genuineness of our faith is purified and tested by fire, by the various trials that we endure. In chapter 4 of 1 Peter, in verse 12, he says, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you. But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy." Our trials might not look like getting thrown into a furnace. I certainly hope they don't. Might look more like a difficult week at work that puts strain on relationships with our family members. Maybe it's an argument with somebody that we care about. Maybe it's financial issues. Maybe it's health issues. Maybe it's a vehicle breaking down at the wrong time. Dustin's head came up on that one. That happens to him a lot for some reason. But maybe that's your fiery trial. Maybe it's unemployment. Maybe it's a disability. We can expect God's deliverance, but we also need to be ready to endure it, because we're probably going to get thrown in before we get pulled out. It's the pattern in the scriptures. That's just how it seems to go. The bottom line is, if we experience any of these things, are we going to continue to serve God, or are we going to choose to give up on him because we don't see his help immediately? There's a choice that we can make there. God will come through for us if we are willing to endure in faith. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 3 for a moment. Daniel chapter 3, verse 26. It says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God." Isn't that ironic? The end of chapter 2 is calling him the God of gods and the Lord of kings. And then it was, well, why won't you bow down and serve this idol? He says, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." So they come from the midst of the fire. Verse 27, "The satraps, the administrators, the governors, the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected. Not even the smell of fire was on them." Isn't that something? Not even the smell of the fire was allowed to touch them. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god. You know, there's some things in the Bible that you might get inspired by. Maybe it's Hebrews chapter 11, and you want to make that list. This is one of those for me. They trusted in him. They frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god. We should want that to be said about us. In verse 29, he makes a decree. Nebuchadnezzar's kind of famous for this. He goes one direction, then he just makes a 180 and goes the other direction really quick. He makes a decree in verse 29. He says that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. And he promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. What we learn from that last passage is that our service to God displays his power and his glory to those who ridicule his followers. Our service to God and our sacrifices in his service, the trials that we endure, our conduct, they display his power and his glory to those who ridicule his followers, who speak evil of his followers. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11. So he writes to these Christians, "Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation." It turns it around. Do you see how Nebuchadnezzar started out with, after Daniel interpreted his dream, he started out with, he's the God of gods, he's the Lord of kings, and then he's going to come over here and make a golden image and speak evil of the people who want to just serve God and won't bow down to this image. Do you see how much their endurance of this and their trust in God turned him around from that? He started out with, if you don't worship this idol, I'll throw you in the fiery furnace. And he ended with, if you speak evil against the God of the Israelites, I'll cut you into pieces and burn your house down. That's a big change. And it was brought about by the conduct of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Again, ours isn't going to look like that. But we can have that effect on people. If we're keeping the analogy really close to the story, it's probably going to look more like school or work, where you endure a trial, and the person who puts you through that trial, your boss, your teacher, your supervisor, whatever it is, they see your conduct in that, and they start to think about you differently. They start to think about what leads your life differently. Might even get curious and ask you about it. And there's your chance to talk to him about the Lord. Our conduct displays God's power and glory to those who would speak evil of the people who follow him. I like to think about the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in line with an illustration that is often used to describe the situation. It's a blacksmith. If you imagine, a blacksmith in his workshop notices a tool that he regularly uses has a small crack in it. If you ever work with wrenches or hammers or tongs, something like that breaks, it's a detriment to what you're trying to do. He notices a tool that he regularly uses, has a small crack in it. It's nothing serious, so he continues to use it regularly. And over time, the more he uses it, the more the crack in that tool grows. Eventually, it becomes a problem. That tool's getting ready to break. He doesn't just coddle the tool and treat it nicely. He doesn't just hang it up on the wall and tell it its work it's done. He doesn't do that. The blacksmith decides he needs to fix the imperfection in his tool, so he starts up his forge, starts up his furnace. He gets that furnace hot, and he puts that tool in the furnace with heat that is almost unbearable. And then he pulls out that tool from the furnace, and instead of then taking care of it, he begins to strike it with his hammer over and over again, putting more and more stress on it. It's been heated up to almost an unbearable temperature. It's been struck with a hammer. But what begins to happen is he shapes it into the form that he desires it to have. He welds that crack back together. That tool is now perfect for the task for which he needs it. God is able to refine us, to fix us. But most of the time, that's not going to happen through a hedge. Remember Job? Job didn't have a hedge. Job got thrown into the furnace. And he got beat with a hammer. And he came out more righteous. That's how God operates. We shouldn't expect our faith to grow by having so many blessings in our lives that we don't have any troubles. We should expect our faith to grow when we are put in situations where it has to. God allows those things to happen to us because he's refining us and making us more perfect for his service. So this morning, if you feel like you've been thrown into the furnace, your brethren are here to help you with that kind of thing. It's part of what we're supposed to do when we endure those fiery trials is rely on each other. So if you need the prayers of the brethren, we offer that invitation now for you to come forward and ask.